Hello and welcome to This Is Going Well, I Think with David Cooper, the show where no one's listening and no one cares, the show where every episode's the last episode. I'm your host, David Cooper, so pull up a chair and sit around because the show's gonna start right now! We got a great lineup for you tonight. We've got conspiracy theory expert Nathan Radke to have a conversation that was sparked by the Meshuggah poor guy who set himself on fire outside of the courthouse in New York during the Trump trial. From that, we'll discuss the dangers of conspiratorial thinking. And after that, do you like cars that are really loud with modified pipes? It turns out you're probably young, you're probably male, and you probably score high on the psychopathy and sadism scales. A wild claim, you say? Yes, it is, but a psychology professor has done the research, and this seems to be true, so we'll have her on the show after Nathan. Now, if that doesn't sound like a great show, by golly, I don't know what does. Did I really just say by golly? But first, this. And it's that special time of day, the Seaman's Alive with Tony Five. Tony Five, our foreign correspondent, a very British man, is on a cruise ship somewhere in the Mediterranean going port to port to port. That's three ports or more. And every day he's providing a recorded update. Today, no different. And with a little luck, Tony's not trapped under the sea. Day 7 of Tony's travels, Wednesday, May the 1st.
Good morning, David. Good morning, listeners. And I'm here on dry land in Firenze, or as you like to call it, Florence. I'm here in the town square opposite the Palazzo Vecchio, which is the Palazzo Vecchio, apparently. And here in front of a huge statue of a bloke with the tiniest penis you have ever seen. It is magnificently small, which I know, David, you kind of tune in with. A fantastic white guy with the tiniest penis and really, really small testicles. It's surprising this place was ever populated, in all fairness. As you can hear, there are lots of Italians around me. Buongiorno, everybody. Buonasera. And they love Tony Five. And walking around. That's what we'll do is if you listen very carefully, listeners, you'll hear the quiet, dulcet tones of the lesser known American walking around with huge ice creams and asking for pizza. But here we go. They're coming back. They're coming past us. There you go. I don't know whether you guys heard that, but it was an American walking past us, more than likely from Texas. Anyway, guys, just wanted to let you know I'm here. I'm still alive. Just had a bit of pizza. Going to find a McDonald's and head back to the ship slightly later. Wish me luck. Goodbye, David. Goodbye, listeners. Speak to you soon.
Stardate 69, 69, 69. This is Tony Five, live from the cruise ship, Seaman on Seaman. Hope you're well, people. Just got back from Florence. Firenze, as they call it here in the Dordogne. Beautiful city, had a wonderful time. Absolute f***ing chaos on the way back. I believe a group of Chinese tourists think I'm one of the onboard staff. They thank me profusely all the time and walk past me. One of them gave me a drink today. Unfortunately, it was an empty cup. That's what I think. They think I work on the ship. Very strange, but I'm just very polite. So I took it off them and I just put it on the floor. But let's see how that goes. That's a side project of mine. But yeah, it's going well. It's been a good day. It's been a very exhausting day. Lots of walking. And tomorrow is Cannes. So some of the listeners might know the Cannes Film Festival and obviously baked bean Cannes. Exciting. The ship actually doesn't go to port. It stays in the sea and you get a tender. Again, for the Americans, not a chicken tender, just a tender boat. And you get a tender to the shore and then you have a sort of a day out and then you have to get a tender back. So you've got to book all these tenders and so on. So I booked the tender and got to go on board. Do you reckon there's a Tinder for tender? That'd be pretty cool, wouldn't it? Like tender.com and then like you swipe left or swipe right for like the different boats you want. That'd be pretty cool. David, put that on our list of things to do to look at. But anyway, apart from that, we're coming to the end of the cruise quite shortly. Maybe 3 days, 4 days left. Hope you've been enjoying my travels. I feel like I'm a modern day Sinbad, which is pretty cool. Hope you all appreciate it. As always, anybody wants a postcard, please send the details in to David and they will get one. The last guy that asked for one, his one is en route, which is French for en route. When I get back from the cruise. So anyway, this is Tony Five signing off. Good night and ahoy.
The Seaman Tony Five continues to be alive. You heard it from him. If you want a postcard from Tony, send me an email with your address. My email is david@jew.pizza. That's dot pizza, not dot com. david@jew.pizza. Now let's mosey on to the stories of the day. Hello there. Welcome in. I'm here to toss you today's special from the Big Apple, New York City, where apparently not even the city's police department can escape the latest horrible health fad. No, it is not kale smoothies. It's not a juice cleanse. It's steroids. So get this. The city's largest cop union is suing their big boss, the police commissioner, and Mayor Eric Adams. Why? Because starting on December 26th last year, our boys in blue, the NYPD, got hit with a, quote, zero tolerance policy on flexing those manly police muscles unnaturally. They banned steroid use amongst cops. I mean, if your job involves chasing down bad guys, allegedly, or just beating up protesters, you wouldn't want to be just naturally fast. No, you'd want to be chemically enhanced, right? So here's the wild part. The Police Benevolent Association aren't just mad, they're lawsuit level mad. They say this new rule where you can't pop steroids without a doctor's note, and even if you have one, you have to show it to a district surgeon, is, well, totally out of line. Only in New York. I mean, if cops are busting people for drugs, shouldn't they not do drugs? You'd think. The NYPD are saying this zero-tolerance policy goes against a cozy little agreement from 2011 that said, and I quote, sure, take your steroids, but let's keep it between us and not bring in a doctor for a note. Now, if any officer decides to take steroids without permission or even tweak their dosage, they're not just getting a slap on the wrist. No, they're facing the boot from the force. The police boot. Yes, they'll be fired for getting a little too pumped up. Sounds like the only performance enhancement that the NYPD will be allowed is a double shot of espresso. Honestly, it makes you wonder, was the gym getting a little too crowded with all those super-sized uniforms? They needed to take a little something extra? Call me old-fashioned, but isn't juicing to get jacked so you can beat up criminals a bit like winning a marathon by hopping on a bus? You might cross the finish line first, but you're probably going to get caught. So as New York's finest gears up to either get natural or get going, let's remember, if you're relying on steroids to beef up your job performance, maybe it's time to switch careers. Go into professional wrestling. Go into somewhere where that's accepted. At least in wrestling, it's all a part of the show. So might we change the NYPD's motto to courtesy, professionalism, respect, and for f*** sake, no steroids. Are you going to Scarborough Fair? Not if you're dead. Here's the scoop on this next one. Imagine showing up for a hospital scan and being greeted with, oh, you're dead. Well, that's exactly what happened to a woman in Scarborough, England. And by the way, she's alive and well, mind you, despite what her hospital records have claimed. Talk about a morbid glitch. Now, the woman this happened to, a spry 62-year-old, had a bit of a shock, and not the kind you get from jamming a fork in an electrical outlet. Upon arriving to a hospital, the staff told her she'd been declared deceased for the past 4 months, which would make her rather late for her own funeral, right? And here I thought my doctor was slow. And this wasn't all a joke, because the little mix-up caused her carer's allowance to be stopped momentarily. Because nothing says rest in peace like cutting off your income. Her husband was understandably upset. Caring for him is what that money was for. Nothing a good chuckle for him couldn't fix, but reviving from a bureaucratic death in England is not that simple. The woman did what any sensible undead person might do. She called her general practitioner, who reassured her the mistake was to be corrected. But when she called the Department for Work and Pensions, their response was flat out, on the computer, you're dead. At this point, I'd suggest changing her last name to Lazarus. And even after clearing up the mess, after resuming the carer's allowance for a husband, the woman was left without any explanation. Who made the mistake? Why? It's a mystery that remains unsolved. As for the woman, she's back to gardening, knitting, and probably stitching together a plan for her next life, or at least just a cozy blanket. And here's to hoping the only date she gets mixed up in the future involve her garden and not her death certificate. Bottom line, if hitting the wrong key on a keyboard is all it takes to declare someone dead, maybe it's time we keep certain incompetent people away from the keyboard. And perhaps any board that matters. So stay alive out there, and I hope this doesn't happen to you. All right, that's it for the stories of the day. We've got conspiratorial thinking and the dangers of it with Nathan Radke, conspiracy theory expert. We'll talk about the guy who set himself on fire outside the courthouse in New York in a moment. It is time for the man of, let's say, the minute. His name is Nathan Radke. He's a cultural history professor at Humber College. He's an expert conspiracy theory conspiratorial conspiratist, and he's got a podcast called The Uncover Up that he co-hosts with some guy who no one cares about. Nathan, welcome to the show.
And thanks for having me on. Man of the Minute. I've always wanted to be a Minute Man.
Yes, me too. What are they, like British soldiers or something, or American? What are we? I don't even know.
I think they were fighting the British soldiers.
That's what I said.
But only they only did it for a minute, or they get ready in a minute. We're not historians.
No. Especially not me. I'm an idiot, but not a historian. You did something fun recently on your podcast, which for those who didn't listen to my nonsense introduction, it's called The Uncover Up Conspiracy Cast. Is that what you call it? A conspiracy cast?
Yeah, conspiracy cast.
But you did something fun with your co-host, Lee. Something you called the Quiz Show Shootout. What is this? Is this just Jeopardy for conspiracy theories?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, the thing is, things have been a little rough over at the podcast. We've been diving into all sorts of very disturbing and strange conspiracies. We just talked about the Bay of Pigs, which is, as it turns out, much more disturbing than I was expecting.
Oh.
And so we needed to cut ourselves some slack and take a break and kind of reflect. We've been doing this now for 6 years. So we wanted to see, we're often accused of being conspiracy experts when we go on the radio or on podcasts or on TV. So we want to see, are we actually conspiracy experts? Best way to do that, Quiz Show Shootout. So my co-host, Dr. Lee Kunla, found in kind of a thrift store a conspiracy-themed trivia game.
What?
And we divided up the cards, and we took turns shooting rapid-fire questions at each other. To see if we had, in fact, learned enough to win this thrift store game. And I'm pleased to say I was victorious, but it was close.
Was it mainstream conspiracies? What is this game? How have I never heard of it? And why is it only available in a thrift store? These are questions you might not know the answer to. But what were some of the questions that they asked of you, or what were some of the conspiracy theories that they touched upon?
Okay, here's one. What is the name of the race of beings created when either angels or aliens came down to Earth and had sexual intercourse with Earth women?
Yes. Did I get it right?
Sort of. It was the Nephilim.
Oh, the Nephilim. Nephilim. I hardly knew him.
Yeah, from the book of Genesis.
Oh, I was actually thinking of the Quran. There's these like half-angel creatures called jinns or...
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you look in those old holy texts, it's amazing some of the weird stuff that these days doesn't get focused on as much because it's sort of tricky to kind of reconcile it. I mean, the Bible is filled with these strange creatures that are covered in eyeballs and wings, and it's bizarre. But in modern days, we're not entirely sure what to do with this, although conspiracists are always sure what to do with it. And that is, of course, to associate whatever they find the strange with aliens.
Absolutely. Okay. Speaking of strange, I wanted to do some rapid fire questions. Well, question of my own. Favorite conspiracy theory in all your time and all your work, what's your favorite one you've come across? The one that gets you the most excited?
I mean, there's a few that get me pretty excited. There's a few that if I start talking about at a party, I will ruin that party. I mean, Project A119, when the American government was coming up with a plan to nuke the moon. I mean, that's kind of amazing.
Gotta nuke something. That's from The Simpsons.
You gotta nuke something. I mean, yeah, the Acoustic Kitty.
Oh, yeah, the weaponized cats.
The weaponized cat? The CIA went through elaborate plans and schemes to try to figure out how to turn cats into listening devices. I mean, these are all great, but I think the one that just captures the essence of Cold War conspiratorial madness is something called Seesaw, which was a real plan. It was developed by the Jasons, which are a top secret group of basically American mad scientists. They were going to create a giant cave underneath the Great Lakes. In that enormous cave, they were going to build the world's largest hydro plant. They were then going to put nuclear bombs on the roof of that cave, so the floor of the Great Lakes. And then, in the event of a nuclear war, they were going to set off those nuclear bombs, drain all of the Great Lakes into this massive hydro plant, which would then create enough electricity to fire up a giant particle accelerator, which would then heat up the Earth's atmosphere in a way that would basically turn it into a force field against incoming missiles.
Obviously, it works. Obviously, they tested it out, and that's why we're alive today.
I can't see a single flaw with any of that.
That is bizarre. I'm just trying to think how much money that would cost. Maybe more than $200?
I mean, $250 to $260. I mean, it entirely depends on, you know, how big of a cave and all these, you know, minor things. Details. We can work out the details.
Okay, well, let's work out the details into the meat of what I wanted to talk to you about. Sparked by a kind of horrifying news story. I think it's always fun to laugh at Trumpos, Trumpers, people who've lost their rocker on the Trump train. But outside the courtroom here in New York recently, when Trump was going in for his trial, somebody set themselves on fire. Turns out this guy wasn't a Trumper after all. And I didn't see that as funny. I think most people wouldn't. I saw it as kind of sad. And to me, it speaks to the dangers of this kind of thinking. And I couldn't think of a better person to have a discussion about that with than you. Can you tell me anything about what happened outside the courtroom before we dive in?
I mean, this is an absolute tragedy. This is, and especially for me, I study conspiracy theories. That means that I spend a lot of time talking to conspiracists and meeting with people like that and infiltrating groups and organizations that have their belief system surrounded by conspiracism. So I know people like this. And for me, that really brings it home what happened to this poor guy. This is an absolute tragedy. So basically what happened, this man, we'll call him Max. He was outside of the courtroom where Trump's trial was going on. He threw a bunch of pamphlets into the air and then set himself on fire and then later succumbed to his injuries, which, as you would expect, were horrifying. Absolutely terrible way to die. Nobody deserves it. And at first, people thought that Max must have been protesting the trial in some way because of the location and the timing. But we know why he did this. He left a manifesto. And based on that manifesto, the trial was an opportunity for him to raise attention for his cause, which, according to his writings, was to warn everyone that Trump and Biden were secretly working together in order to replace America's government with a fascist dictatorship. And everything that you can imagine was sort of brought in on this conspiracy. Crypto, for example. He mentions crypto. He said it wasn't just a Ponzi scam, but in fact, part of an elaborate, deliberate plan to undermine the American economy. A lot of the evidence that he presented came from plots from the TV show The Simpsons.
Oh, no.
Which, I mean, The Simpsons does show up a lot in conspiratorial beliefs. People argue that they can predict the future or that they're, you know, that they've got secret knowledge that's being revealed through code. And what Max said was that The Simpsons was a deliberate brainwashing campaign to make people accept that families were dysfunctional, communities were incapable of solving problems, and that the best we could hope for in our own lives was to be a worker drone who slaves away for an evil billionaire. And then he goes and he mentions specific episodes in this manifesto. He's like, well, in this episode, this happens. And in this episode, Lisa does this. And then this happens. And it isn't just The Simpsons. It's basically all pop culture. Stanley Kubrick, a secret fascist who directed the classic film Dr. Strangelove in order to get people to stop worrying about nuclear annihilation. The Beatles were in on it. Walt Disney was in on it. Everybody was in on it. And this is sort of one of those key things that you can identify that separates healthy skepticism and suspicion from dangerous paranoia. When you get to that point where somebody is talking about how everything is part of one story, how everyone is in on some kind of story. That's a pretty good sign that you have definitely tipped over.
Now, can we draw the lines between someone who's seeing the world like that and they're just a normal person caught up in conspiracies? Or could it be mental illness, or could the two play into each other? Well, I know you're not a psychologist, but like to me, it just sounds like the guy's mentally ill.
But I mean, the distinction between a person who has a mental illness and somebody who doesn't, it's not as clear cut as we would like to believe. I mean, certainly mental illness, it would be an unusual person who never has any kind of encounter with mental illness in their life. This is just, I mean, it's part of the human condition. It's all throughout society. And it is, I mean, look at it this way. Let's talk about peanut butter for a second. So we're surrounded by harmful germs out here in the world, the air we breathe, the surfaces we touch, but we've got these immune systems. They protect us. They keep our bodies healthy. They protect us from the germs. Having an underactive immune system would be dangerous. The germs would be able to get in. They'd be able to wreak havoc with us. But having an overactive immune system can also be deadly. Like, your immune system might detect the presence of peanut butter, totally harmless. But in an attempt to protect you, your immune system starts launching all of its defenses, your nose starts running, your skin breaks out in hives, your throat closes up. And it will do this to try to protect you from an imaginary threat. Well, this metaphor is sort of the difference as well between skepticism and paranoia. Being suspicious and skeptical is like a mental immune system. We need it to be able to detect threats before it's too late and know when people are lying to us, all these other things. But when that suspicion and skepticism turns into full-blown paranoia, it's like an allergic reaction in our minds. We respond in an extreme way to the wrong thing. We see a threat where there isn't one, and it can lead to absolute catastrophe, as we see here.
When we come back, we'll talk more about the dangers of buying into this stuff and how it isn't just always fun in games. I'm here with Nathan Radke. He's a cultural history professor at Humber College and an expert in conspiracy theory analysis. How do you like that? Makes you sound smarter than, well, than me. We are here with Nathan Radke, a history professor of cultural. Did I get that right, Nathan?
Close enough, question mark?
Yes, I did not study anything to do with humanities in university. My ex-wife did all my humanities papers.
My formal training is in sociology and logic.
Isn't that humanities? Isn't everything humanities? It's humans, right?
The humanities.
I took logic, but it was computer science logic, which did not look like philosophy logic at all, so...
No, that would have looked a lot more like math. That would have probably scared me right off of it.
Gates, AND gates, NAND gates, OR gates, XOR gates. Never mind. We are here talking about conspiracy theories, believing them, and the dangers of buying into these things and how things can get out of hand. Like this individual who set himself on fire, believing that there were signs that Biden and Trump together were, I don't know, pulling the wool over our eyes and cryptocurrency was involved. And it's not making sense as I say it, which unfortunately is often how these things play out. It makes a lot of sense in someone's head when they go to explain it. It's baffling to the rest of us. I don't even know what my question is after that, Nathan.
Oh, I've got a question I can ask myself.
Good. Yeah, no, I'm leaving that in the interview. I was crescendoing to a question. I'm like, it was a good crescendo, but no question at the end.
A question that I get asked a lot when I'm doing interviews is, what kind of person succumbs to this kind of conspiratorial thinking?
Wait. What kind of person succumbs to this kind of conspiratorial thinking?
That's an excellent question, David.
Thank you, Nathan.
And the answer is all of us. That's the thing. I mean, the temptation is to hear about something like this happening, and it seems so extreme, so ridiculous, that it almost makes us feel better if we say, oh, this is, you know, mental illness, or this guy must have been some sort of fool. When you read the descriptions by his family and friends, again, he seemed like he was a very intelligent person, very thoughtful person, very curious person. He was a person like all of the rest of us. This kind of thing can happen to anybody. And many of the complaints that he makes that kind of drive his conspiracism, the price of healthcare and education, the demise of the middle class, these are real things. They're based in reality. But once that healthy skepticism turns into a dangerous paranoia, once you think that there's one story that can explain all things, that's when you're in trouble. because that one story is going to grab a hold of you and basically start to dictate the way you see everything, the way you behave. People say you are what you eat. It's much more accurate to say you are what you think. And a story like this, once it gets hold of you, it changes who you are as a person.
It's funny, you mentioned valid grievances can cause people to believe wild explanations for those grievances. I think that's a problem throughout history. Like, you get a group of people, maybe it's the middle class, and they have valid grievances with the government, but then the way that they go to solve it is wild. Like, for example, I think Trump really tapped into valid grievances with a whole group of Americans that have been screwed and looked over and are falling victim to unemployment, to jobs being lost overseas, to inflation. They aren't the haves, they're the have-nots. But then when someone stands up and says, hey, I'll solve all this, they'll sort of buy anything. Not necessarily everyone, but that's the danger there. And so what I'm hearing is that valid grievances can cause people to arrive at pretty wild conclusions.
Especially where there are cynical manipulators who are deliberately looking for people who have valid grievances and then providing them with scapegoats. And this is one of the tragedies of conspiracy theory that I've come across again and again. Part of the reason people are drawn to conspiracy theories and conspiratorial thinking is that they feel like they're being manipulated secretly. And finding out what that conspiracy is a way for them to escape the cycle of manipulation. But what a lot of people don't realize is that often the conspiracy theory itself is a tool of manipulation. It is being fed to them by somebody who is trying to change the way they think and change the way they behave. And so one of the ways that you can manipulate someone is tell them first, hey, someone's trying to manipulate you. And then we become frightened and angry. And of course, when we become frightened and angry, we're more easily manipulated. When then somebody gives us an oversimplified explanation that has a satisfying scapegoat, we are quick to jump to that explanation rather than the long, complicated, chaotic series of structural reasons why we're actually suffering these problems.
I'm thinking of kind of the rise of fascism in countries where they say the opposing political party is out to get you, therefore you have to believe me. They're trying to manipulate you, so you need to believe us. And it's a tool for manipulation. So when we go to this fellow who set himself on fire in New York, that's an example of what can happen when an individual believes in these things and it goes wrong. Are there any examples where it's more widespread, where it's groups of individuals? I can think of Jonestown. I can think of Heaven's Gate. I can think of people who committed mass suicide, who Waco, where they locked themselves up and took arms against the government. What are some of the examples, or how can this happen with groups of people and not just one?
I mean, those are all horrible. Those are all horrible examples, but also excellent examples because they make the point so well. One of the key things about us is that we don't exist in isolation as individuals. We are hyper-social beings, and so much of what we think depends on what the people around us think. And so these stories, these conspiracy stories, they don't just grab hold of a single person. They grab hold of entire communities of people. And to paraphrase Voltaire, if somebody can get you to believe something ridiculous, they can get you to do something terrible. And that's what we have seen over and over again. When one of these conspiratorial belief systems takes over an entire population, as it did in Jonestown, as it did with the Heaven's Gate group, as we're sort of seeing happen with QAnon in the States right now, if you can get people to believe something absurd, you can get them to commit an atrocity.
Is there anything we can do to prevent it when we see it happening around us? Like, someone's got the uncle who's starting to believe QAnon bullshit and they're showing up to Thanksgiving dinner, starting up with everybody more and more. Is there a way to knock people out of it?
It's extremely difficult. We are willing to do almost anything to protect the beliefs that have grabbed a hold of our minds. We are willing to accept all sorts of absurdities if it means that we don't have to change our minds about things. We have this belief that certainty is something that somehow makes us strong, when actually what we should be doing is valorizing uncertainty. We should be making a situation where people can say, I don't know this, or hey, I'm changing my mind about this. This is what actually makes a person strong. If you know somebody and you're worried about sort of how conspiratorial they are getting, it isn't going to work if you're just trying to debunk it or if you're just trying to point out factually why they're incorrect, because they don't believe it for factual reasons. They're going to believe it for emotional reasons. The best thing that you can do with a loved one who is starting to go down this path is listen to them and try to understand why it is that they're feeling this way and try to find some common ground. Try to just listen to them. And then after you've done that and you've established some trust and you've got a conversation that isn't just you butting heads with the person, then you can sort of like slowly and gently start to interrogate some of the theory behind it and point out some of the inconsistencies and ask questions. If you can ask questions to somebody that causes them to give answers that makes them reconsider their position, then it makes them feel that you haven't dragged them somewhere, that they have gone there on their own. And basically, that's what you have to do. You have to use empathy and compassion and caring and patience, all of which are, of course, very hard when what you want to do is take somebody and shake them.
Yeah. And if we go back to the valid grievances thing, you can be empathetic to the grievances, but sort of ask why you're jumping to these wild conclusions. That way you've got common ground and you agree on the starting place, but then maybe not, you know, UFOs have taken over the government and that wouldn't even make sense. But the aliens in the UFOs, Nathan, my goodness. Nathan, as always, today, more than all other days, thank you for being here with me.
Well, more than all other days, thank you for having me.
All right. Nathan's podcast is called The Uncover Up. He co-hosts it with Dr. Lee Kunla. And Nathan is a professor of cultural. Nathan Radke is a professor of cultural history at Humber College. Now, I recently saw an article about a study that says people who like loud cars are probably young, they're probably male, and they score high on psychopathy and sadism tests. In short, they're psychopaths. We'll have the psychology professor who did that study here in just a moment. Vroom, vroom, vroom. If you like loud cars, there is a new study that suggests you might be young, you might be male, and you probably score high in psychopathy and sadism. I have someone who's done research into this. Her name is Dr. Julie Aiken-Shermer, and she's a professor of psychology at the University of Western Ontario. Dr. Shermer, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start here. What are your experiences with loud cars as an individual before we get into the study?
Well, I walk to the university regularly with my dog, and daily we're startled by a loud car backfiring. We hear them late at night roaring around, and so I wondered, you know, who actually wants to drive a car that sounds like it's about to explode? And so I, typical academic nerd, I went into the literature and looked around and I could not find any research on the topic. So I did a pilot study to see, you know, why do people want to drive their cars so loud?
So how did you construct this study? What were you looking to find?
Well, I was thinking initially that maybe it was narcissism, that people were saying, hey, look at me. You know, if you make a loud noise, like, for example, if I go into a classroom and I do the throat clearing, I'm expecting the students to look at me. And so I thought maybe it has something to do with narcissism. Where's a good narcissism measure? And I remember Del Polis's scale from, he's at University of British Columbia, and he has what's called the short dark tetrad. And it measures Machiavellianism, which is manipulating others to get ahead, narcissism or grandiose self-love, sadism, which is enjoying watching other people suffer, and psychopathy, which is a callous disregard for how your actions are affecting others. And so I included that, and I created three pilot questions, and I asked students, you know, my car is an extension of what makes me a person. How much do you agree with that statement? How much do you agree with I think loud cars are really cool? And asked them, if I could, I would make my car louder with muffler modification. Now, some people have said, well, why did you ask students? And it's like, well, every time I was startled by a car, I did look over and it seemed to be a young individual driving the vehicle. So I thought, well, this is a good, you know, sample that I can draw from. And I have been trying to remind everybody, it is a pilot study. It is the first one. And so it doesn't mean it's a definitive one-to-one answer in terms of who are driving these. Like, you're not going to say, oh, you must be this. So when we did the analysis with over 500 undergraduate students that completed the measures, and found that my CAR items worked well together as a scale, put them together, and then tried to predict them with the personality measures. And we found that it was younger males in terms of demographics, but they were scoring higher on sadism and psychopathy. And so narcissism didn't play a role.
That's wild. Were you surprised by these results?
I was. I had to admit, I had to spend quite a bit of time figuring that out, because so it suggests that if you make your car very loud and you're simply enjoying other people being disturbed by it, that's what you're getting a kick in. That's the sadism component. And you're indifferent to whether or not it is upsetting them, and that's the psychopathy. And so what really drove it home to me is that I was probably maybe on the right track. Was last summer I was in a conference in Belfast in Northern Ireland, and sure enough, there was these young guys driving this little car that had been made, the muffler had been modified, so it was roaring around and backfiring regularly. But it was the first time I'd ever seen a passenger filming people's reactions to it. And so that is clearly sadism, because they wanted to watch people get startled by this event taking place.
Not to mention loud car modifications, perhaps not all of them, but some of them pollute more. And I think when people get car inspections, they have to very quickly reverse the modification only to do it again to pass emissions tests. But here's another question. Did you adjust for cultural significance? For example, if in someone's family background, maybe their dad really loved cars and now they love cars, is there a possibility that people are into this stuff not for these sort of negative reasons?
There is a possibility. I did not adjust for that. We are doing some follow-up studies. But like, for example, there's a big difference between illegally modifying your vehicle so that it's loud and you know you're breaking the law, versus those individuals with classic cars that will take them to charitable events and will, like, they're there for an altruistic reason in that sense. They're helping others with their vehicle. So they're not the ones that are roaring around at 2 a.m, waking up people in the neighborhood. One of the things that I thought was quite startling about the pattern of predictors I found was that when you look at the criminology literature, it's the same predictors of people who commit arson. So it does seem that these people know they're doing something illegal and they're just going to go ahead and do it.
Wow, arson and loud pipe modifications. That's quite the surprising connection. How's the public reacted to this study? Do you have car enthusiasts who are coming at you and saying this is all wrong? What are people saying?
Well, I've had a lot of fan mail, and I've had some interesting hate mail. The hate mail, I think, I find more intriguing because in some ways it almost verifies my pattern of findings. I had one individual who suggested I get earplugs. Another person suggested that I should get a hobby. And I don't reply to them, but I was really tempted to say I do have a hobby and it's gardening and I don't disturb anybody doing it. And then I had a good laugh. I actually laughed out loud at one where the individual said that I was clearly one of those people that text and drove at the same time. I don't own a cell phone, so I can't text anybody. And so I thought that was interesting that they thought I was somehow breaking the law as well.
How would they even make that connection? That's what I'm saying.
Well, I think it's just that they want to despise, they invent with somebody. So they create, you know, I become, maybe I hit a nerve, I don't know, and they wanted to, fight back somehow. It's better than, I guess, saying you're wrong, you know, without being able to sort of verify the claims. So, but the interesting how, you know, largely geographic this problem is. I've had people from not just Canada, but I've had the US contacting me. I've had Luxembourg was contacting me, an individual from the UK was contacting me. And so it seems that it's a pervasive problem in a lot of different countries.
So with this issue of noise pollution and people contacting you from all over, do you think your research could maybe influence policy or community standards around loud cars?
Well, it's interesting because the municipal governments in Canada are the ones that are responsible for noise bylaws. And there's a few cities that are trying to come up with what are referred to as quiet cities. And so I've had a few people ask me, well, would an information campaign work? And it's interesting because here in London, Ontario, they're trying an information campaign to try to dissuade people from illegally setting off fireworks in their backyards on non-sanctioned days. And yet, regularly, fireworks are set off. And so on days that they're not allowed to. So I said, maybe not an information campaign, because if a person is higher on self-report psychopathy, they're not going to feel any sort of remorse for what they're doing in terms of their actions. So maybe it can only be an enforcement that will stop. We have gotten rid of, when you were saying about emissions testing, the Ontario government here in Canada has actually gotten rid of emissions testing. So cars aren't being checked that way. Our deputy mayor has informed me that the last time the traffic police here in London did a blitz, they were able to quickly lay over 100 charges for loud vehicles.
Wow. So do you know anyone personally, or anyone's children, friends who have done these modifications? Because I have one friend, and I got to say, your study really matches to what I think of this friend. He is a bit of a psychopath, and he really acts like his car's an extension of himself. Do you know anyone who's done this personally?
No, but interestingly, I was asked by a radio producer in Halifax, and he said that his nephew was the nicest guy you would ever meet, and he also had a modified muffler. And I said, well, if he's a nice guy, then usually nice and consideration go together. And so if you told him that it was disturbing others, would he, you know, make his car quieter? And I didn't get a reply to that, which I thought was interesting.
It's always the nice and quiet ones, isn't it? I myself own a motorcycle, and I have not modified the tailpipe. It's about as loud as it can be out of the dealership. And honestly, any louder would just be embarrassing. And I don't know why people do this, but I guess this study is starting to reveal the kinds of people who do it. One more question. You mentioned it's just the first bit of research. Are there any ways in which you're planning on expanding the study or doing a new study?
Yes, we just finished collecting data on a follow-up study, and we looked at Schadenfreude, which is a enjoyment in other people's misfortune. So
Schadenfreude, I believe, is the German word. I love that word.
And so, you know, the person that would laugh at somebody who's slipping on a banana peel, and as opposed to showing concern for how, you know, did they hit their head? Are they okay? And we are finding that in our preliminary data screening that there seems to be a positive prediction. So it could be that it's indicative of that sadism component.
Dr. Shermer, thanks so much for going over this study with me.
Thank you.
Dr. Julie Aitken-Shermer, she's a psychology professor at the University of Western Ontario. All right, okay, all right. That's our show. I'll be here tomorrow. Thank you for making it this far. Stay sleazy.